All right, so tonight we are in Proverbs chapter 26. And we'll just go ahead and dive right in. I believe I am running reading from the ESV tonight. I can't be absolutely certain, but I'm pretty sure that's what I'm doing. And starting verse 1, like snow in summer or rain in harvest, so honor is not fitting for a fool. Like a sparrow in its flitting, like a swallow in its flying, a curse that is causeless does not alight. Now that second one might need a little bit of description. There are two possible meanings of verse 2, both of which are seen in different translations. So what I just read may not align with the translation that you read. Either meaning, either the either this means that a curse without a cause will not enter with the implication that it will not achieve its goal, or it means it will come back and bite the person who spoke the curse. Okay? So in other words, it can mean that it's not going to land, it's not going to actually alight, it's not going to actually have the impact it was that they designed it to have by landing well, or it means it's going to come back and bite them. One of the two, based on the way it's read and the way it's translated. The Masoretic text, which is what the King James, New King James, some other translations use, has the negative with the verb to enter, to come, so to make it will not come. Okay? This is interpreted to mean will not come to rest or will not return back home. So it would mean in that case, it would mean that a curse that is causeless will come back and hit them. Okay? I'm sorry. Well, I'm sorry. Is that right? Well, I'm sorry. Will not come back and bite them. It will just fail to accomplish its goal. So some commentators have taken another reading of the text so as to read it with the positive, so that the curse will come back to him. So there's will and there's will not. This is also a little difficult because it gives the idea that an undeserved curse will come back to him who just gave it. Just as a bird will fly around and eventually come home, so will the undeserved curse return back to the one who spoke it. This is plausible, but there's not a referent suffix in the text, and so it makes it syntactically difficult to translate. In either translation, though, the end result is the unwarranted curse will ultimately fail in its objective. That we know, okay? Ultimately, it's going to fail. Whether it fails by not actually hitting the target and having its impact, or whether it's going to fail because it circle backs and hits the person that spoke it, either way, it's going to fail. Okay, so verse 3, a whip for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of fools. Now, it's no surprise that what passes for science in the modern age is at variance with verses like this, because animal science today is driven more by sentimentality and evolutionary environmental devotions to the idea of human beings being the disease on the planet than it is in straight up real science. So they have a tendency to drivel on about the virtues of animals and the baseness of humans. And so to hear the words a whip for a horse and a bridle for a donkey is like the need for a whip on a horse and a bridle for a donkey is similar to the need of a rod on the back of a fool. And so that's not true. If you really understand a horse, it doesn't need to be whipped. If you really understand a donkey, it doesn't need this. And that's just poppycock. This is no more accurate than saying that the only reason humans rebel is because of their involvement with God. The argument today is that the only reason a horse would need to be chided on, or a donkey to put a bridle in their mouth, is because of the way the human being is interacting with them. And I'm not saying that that can't have impact, but I'm saying, and I think the verse is very clearly saying, that the native disposition of the creature is not automatically tamed. They have to be tamed. They have to learn to be disciplined by their owner. Has to be. That's the way that it is, especially with a wild animal. So if it were not for God being who he is in relation to human beings, there would be nothing for a human being to rebel against. And so it is in regard to the relationship of a human and one of these beasts. they don't automatically have a relationship with us. It has to be developed, and most of that begins and at least initially begins with a reward and punishment based system. And that's what this is talking about. Now, I say all of that to point out that according to Solomon, a horse needs a whip and a donkey a bridle for the same reason that a fool needs a rod, and he's not wrong. According to Charles Bridges, this proverb inverts our ideas, because when we should have given the bridle to a horse and a whip for the donkey. That's what we typically do. We put a bit in a horse's mouth, and you might use a whip on a donkey. But in the Eastern donkey, because this is not talking about a Western world, this is talking about 3,500 years ago in the Middle East. So we're dealing with something radically different than the way we deal with things today. The Eastern donkey were very, very superior race of what do they call those? Equines or?
Equines.
Okay. All of the same horse family, if you will. Both in beauty and spirit, a valuable piece of property to their owners, a donkey more so even than a horse in more common usage. The bridle is necessary to curb and guide them, while the horse, perhaps badly broken in, may need a whip, if dull, to accelerate his speed, if fiery, to correct his temper. Every creature subdued for the service of man needs his appropriate discipline. The Lord guides his children with his own eyes, but let them cultivate a pliable spirit, as not as the horse or the mule, whose mouth must be held with a bit and bridle, as it says in Psalm 32. The fool neither hears the voice nor sees the directing eye. He will be ruled neither by reason or persuasion. A rod, therefore, is for a fool's back. So, in my opinion, just reading it straightforward would be fine. But I like to check things out when I'm reading them. And when I saw that immediately, I thought, well, whip on a horse. That if you said that in public today, people would just automatically think you're the most horrible person in the world. You don't understand horses. And would automatically consider the scripture to be wrong, which I already know can't be wrong. So that required me to do some searching into the meaning behind the verse. So now, verse 4. Another, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Now, obviously, Solomon knew that these two statements began the same, but ended with what appears to be contradictory advice. I believe that this is the form of poetry the parallelism demands that one interpretation, one interpret the beginning of both verses differently, though they were deliberately written in a way to make them appear the same. This is clearly a paradoxical parallelism, which is expressed through antithetical and synthetic parallelism. I'm going to explain that. You don't have to worry about understanding it. But I did tell you before we cracked the book of Proverbs, there are at least four or five different types of parallelism, and you're going to run into them in this book, okay? And understanding them helps unlock the meaning of some of the passages, and this is a big one, okay? What this means is that at first glance, the wisdom offered is a paradox. But knowing this is wisdom literature, one should expect certain plays on words which are intended to draw the mind in for closer consideration to solve the paradox. I believe this is done by acknowledging that the beginning statements of both are actually antithetical, meaning they contrast rather than agree. On the surface, it looks like they agree with one another, right? Let's read it. It says, answer a fool according to his folly. Okay? The second one says, answer a fool according to his folly. So they sound identical, don't they? The latter part sounds different. But in reality, the part that sounds like they're saying the same thing are actually saying something different. It's intended to be paradoxical. Okay? So, and I'm going to help you understand this. Now, this is what I came up with on my own just by studying it. I was very interested after I got done and was wondering whether I was correct. I was pretty sure I was. I submitted the entire text to an AI dissemination and came up with the exact same thing that I did. So I was pretty impressed by that. But the idea is that the first glance, the wisdom offered is a paradox. And I believe this is done by acknowledging that the beginning statements of both are actually antithetical, meaning that they contrast each other rather than agree. This therefore forces the second part of each statement to actually be synthetic, meaning they complete the overall thought rather than contradict it. It really is quite clever the way this was written. As such, I believe it to be a literary ploy intended to make one think through a cleverly concealed yet obvious truth. One should not answer a fool in line with the fool's mode of reasoning, or you will be no better than they are. But when you answer a fool, answer him in a way which demonstrates their folly in their own reasoning. So when you answer them using their own logic to prove how illogical their logic is. Okay? And that's what it's saying. To me, this is the most obvious and straightforward understanding of an otherwise apparently contradictory statement. And like I said, after coming to these conclusions, I thought I'd allow AI to offer a stab at it, and surprisingly found that what we said was nearly identical. This is what it said. Proverbs 26:4 and 26:5 are an excellent example of parallelism found in Hebrew poetry. The two verses, which appear contradictory on the surface, are placed together to present a composite truth that requires the reader to use wisdom to discern in application. Types of parallelism used: antithetical, synthetic, and paradoxical. Exactly what I said. Okay? Antithetical. This is the most common interpretation, where the second line is set in contrast to the first, using opposing idea to make a point. The verse highlights opposite scenarios and consequences. Verse 4, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. This applies when engaging would drag you down to their level and make you appear just as foolish as they are. Verse 5, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. This applies when a lack of response would allow the fool to think their foolish ideas were actually wise or correct, which could influence others. Synthetic parallelism, completing the thought, which means completing the thought, some scholars view it as synthetic parallelism, where the second line builds upon or completes the thought of the first by providing additional necessary perspective. Both statements are true and offer complementary guidance for different situations with that type of individual. Paradoxical truth. The juxtaposition creates a paradox that forces the reader to think deeply and apply the right instruction to the right situation rather than following a simple, rigid rule that applies to everyone. The brilliance of this poetic device is that it challenges the reader to seek divine guidance, like in James 1:5, to know when to speak and when to remain silent rather than offering a simple, one-size-fits-all instruction. So, again, the idea is that you answer, let me back up again to where the verse is. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. Meaning, in other words, don't follow the same line of reasoning. Don't enter into his base type of thinking. Because if you do and you argue on that level, you're going to be just like him. But you do answer a fool according to his folly, meaning using his own logic in order to unlock in his mind how illogical his conclusions were. Okay? That's what it's trying to say. All right? Again, it requires a little bit of thinking to get through it. I have no doubt that when writing that, Solomon probably had a grin on his face, because he probably enjoyed writing something that was paradoxical, that seemed like it was saying one thing when in fact it was saying something else. Uh-huh, go ahead.
Are these... Solomon's words.
Yes, these are.
Are Solomon's words.
Yeah. Now we will get into an area where that are not Solomon's words before we get done with the book of Proverbs, but these are. Yes. Okay, so verse 6. Whoever sends a message by the hand of a fool cuts off his own feet and drinks violence. Like a lame man's legs, which hang useless, is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Now, I had my own ideas regarding these two verses, but after reading the notes associated with them in the New English Translation, I decided I would be hard-pressed to improve upon or even say it more concisely or clearly, so I'm just going to read it to you. Sending a messenger on a mission is like having another pair of feet. But if the messenger is a fool, this proverb says, not only does the sender not have an extra pair of feet, but he cuts off the pair that he has. It has it's it would not be simply that the message did not get through. It would get through incorrectly and be set back. The other simile uses violence, a term for violent social wrongs or injustice. The metaphorical idea of drinking violence means suffering violence, means to drink it in, okay, to be the recipients of violence. It is one's portion. So sending a fool on a mission will have injurious consequences. So that's, and I thought pretty much the same thing, but I like the way they worded it better, so I just ran with what they said. Verse 8, like one who binds the stone in the sling is one who gives honor to a fool. Now, okay, this one made me actually laugh when I read it, because in part because it's so silly, and in part because of the mental imagery it conjures is kind of cartoonish. And finally, because I've done things which are equally ridiculous and self-defeating, having not grasped the stupidity of it until after I did it. I don't know if you've ever done that before, but so the key to understanding the verse is not reading past the word bind. One lays a stone in the pouch of a sling so that it will release in projection towards its intended target. But if you bind it into the cradle so it can't be released at the time of the greatest impact in the sling, it's going to swing around and smack you back in the head, you know? So that makes it kind of cartoonish if you get a visual image of it. So if you bind it in the cradle, then upon snapping it back so as to release the stone and hurl it towards its goal, it'll instead circle back around and hit you with similar force. The point is that only someone who does not know how to work a sling would be so foolish, and in similar fashion, to honor a fool would not only be stupid and counterproductive, it will probably come back on you. So it's just a really clever device. I like the way he wrote it. Verse 9, like a thorn that goes up into the hand of a drunkard is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Again, really, just really good imagery here. Meaning, a drunkard, you're going to have a thorn go up through your hand, and you're going to be wounded and not even realize it, right? So, meaning it hurts them, speaking to their lack of wisdom, and against their folly, but they're too dull to realize it, right? So, like a thorn that going up into the hand of a drunkard is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. What they're saying speaks to their lack of wisdom, but they don't even realize it. They don't even realize that what they just said told on them. Verse 10, like an archer who wounds everyone is one who hires a passing fool or drunkard. Now, I already know King James, New King James people are going to read much different than this. The verse has it has its difficulties. I'll just say that in translation. But when one considers all the options, this one is the only one which I believe makes sense without reading into the text more than can be rightly justified. The King James and New King James has something along the lines of, the great God who formed everything gives the fool his hire and the transgressor his wage. While no one could disagree with that statement, it reads too much into the text and takes too many liberties, in my view. The net notes do a good job explaining the differences and their reasons. An archer is one who wounds anyone, and the employer of a fool is particularly the employer of those just passing by. This translation understands the participles substantively rather than verbally. In a battle, again, you have to put yourself back in their day. We're not talking about Robin Hood in a forest, a single guy with a single bow aiming at a single target. Back then when archers were used, it was a whole line of them shooting up into the sky and raining arrows down on a whole crowd. No one's really aiming specifically at anyone. They're just aiming that direction, okay? So in a battle, archers are not intentionally taking aim to hit an individual bullseye. They shoot as a group high in the air at the approaching enemy forces, who then find themselves in a hail of dangerous arrows. The individual archer is indiscriminate. When someone hires whoever is passing by indiscriminately, that employer is more likely to end up with an incompetent or foolish employee. The words in the line have several possible meanings, making it difficult and often considered textually defective. In the first line, Rav Meckenhall Kol, which is the way it's pronounced in the Hebrew. The first word, Rav, means archer, master, or much. Well, that's where the King James gets the idea of master, related to God, okay? Verb, Minkenhol, can mean to wound or to bring forth. Well, based on how you plug that in, it's going to have a radically different reading. Can you see that? The possibilities are a master performs or produces all, a master injures all, an archer wounds all, or much produces all. Well, there's only two of those that you can twist to make any sense whatsoever, and the one that takes more twisting than anything else is the way the King James and the New King James went with it, okay? So I decided that this is probably the accurate meaning. The line probably should be stating something negative. So the idea, and we know that because of the construction of the Hebrew. Therefore, that also gives you a reason not to believe that it's talking about the great God giving to people who don't deserve it. That's something positive rather than something negative, whereas the construction of the Hebrew implies something negative is happening. Therefore, you default back to an archer just wounding someone at random, okay? So that makes sense? So an undisciplined hireling will have the same effect as an archer shooting at anything and everything. An archer who shoots recklessly is like the New Living Translation says. Additionally, I thought the Jewish Publication Society of the Old Testament offered an interesting take on this verse. It represents the verse this way. A master performeth all things, but he that stoppeth a fool is as one that stoppeth a flood. So, interesting. That one right there and the one that I read to you initially from the ESV, I think say the same thing using different verbiage. The only one that is just off in willy-nilly land, I think, is the King James, the New King James. And I think they really do kind of strain at a gnat to force that translation. It doesn't even really make sense. I mean, it does, but it's really not so much of a proverbial statement. I mean, God does cause the sun and the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. We know he loves them both the same. And so the way the King James reads, it's not that what it's saying is wrong, but it really doesn't offer much of a proverbial statement. And it's also got the one glitch that in the Hebrew, this statement should be read in the negative. And there's nothing negative about that statement. So therefore, I went with the one that I had, okay? Verse 11, and the reason why I can't always feel like I need to justify why I go through so much depth in some of these. But again, if you were to read like I do, when I read something, I often will read in multiple translations. And if you run into something that is that radically different between two translations, you're scratching your head thinking, why? Weren't they both translating the same Hebrew document? So I feel like it's important to give you a little bit of backstory to understand it. Really, if you understand the language, and I'm not claiming I do understand ancient Hebrew like that, I don't, but talking and reading from people who do understand it can give their reasons as to why different translations could come up with something that seems so wildly different, and how to, at that point, you're kind of left with, now that I've got all the pieces of the puzzle, I can come to a conclusion based on what I can see here as to which one is probably the accurate one. And I told you why I came to the conclusion I did, because number one, the way the King James and New King James say it really isn't so much a proverbial statement. And number two, it's positive rather than negative. And so those two things shove me in the direction of the other interpretation. Is everybody understanding? Okay. And this just helps you, because whenever you are reading passages, if you find something that is wildly different, spend some time with it. The scripture tells us that we are supposed to study to show ourselves approved unto God, right? A workman that doesn't need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And so, you know, just spend a little bit of time with it. Don't just shove it off. There's wisdom there. And I got to tell you, usually you've got to work to get more meat off that bone. It's more gratifying and ministers to you more than if it was something that was just very easy to grasp. You had something, Doris.
Right. And on the literal translation, it says great is a former, not meaning past, increase, former of all things. And then it just goes to say, but he who hires a fool is like one who hires those passing by. Totally different
than
what King James has.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And I did see that in that version as well. And like I said, the possibilities just for that first part are a master performs for or produces all, a master injures all, an archer wounds all, or much produces all. Well, you know, that's just a pretty broad spectrum. And how do you put that together into the statement so that it makes something cohesive? And I think that one is probably the most accurate. So going on verse, did you have a question too, hon? No? You. Okay. Verse 11. Like a dog that returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. Now this verse has its own interpretation clarified for us in Peter's second letter regarding the apostate Christian. He says, and this is quoting from 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 14 through 22. It says, they have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed. They are accursed children. Forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain from wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with a human's voice and restrained the prophet's madness. These are waterless springs and mists driven by a storm. For them, the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved. For speaking loud boasts of folly, they entice by sensual passions of the flesh those who are barely escaping from those who live in error. They promise them freedom, but they themselves are slaves of corruption. For whatever overcomes a person, to that he is enslaved. For if after they have escaped the defilements of the world through the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the last state has become worse than the first. For it would have been better for them to have never known the way of righteousness than after having known it to turn back from the holy commandment delivered to them. What the true proverb says has happened to them. A dog returns to his own vomit, and the sow, after washing herself, returns to wallowing in the mire. So we have a very clear understanding now of what this is depicting. A person who, now it doesn't have to be just talking about a Christian. I mean, what Peter's saying there does, that's very clear. But you could apply this to anything, you know. You could say, you know, for a person to say they had a tire that was repaired because they drove onto this happened to me a lot when I used to work on construction sites. If you're dumb enough to pull onto a construction site, you're probably going to get a flat tire because there's nails and stuff sticking out everywhere. And so, I mean, if you do that once, you know, shame on the people that left it there and without a sign. But after I get my tire repaired, if I pull on the same property at the same time, well, then, you know, I'm just an idiot. You know, I after having my tire fixed to go back in there just to get it deflated again, it's very much like a dog returning to its own vomit, or a sow after having been washed goes back to wallowing in the mud again. This is the same idea. So, I thought it was important to bring this to the other place in Scripture where it's quoted. This very passage is what Peter was referring to in 2 Peter, and he applied it to the apostate Christian. Verse 12, do you see a man who is wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him. The reason why is because such is a proud person, possessing no ears to hear anything but things that agree with their own beliefs and their own thoughts. This person is cut off from grace, making a fool in a better position for a favorable outcome than he has, right? Because a proud person, God says God is resisting them, but he gives grace to the humble, right? So they've cut themselves off. So that makes a fool in a better position than this person. Now, we have four verses focused upon the sluggard. Verse 13, the sluggard says, there's a lion in the road. There's a lion in the streets. Of course, he's using that as an excuse to not go outside. As a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard does on his bed. Verse 15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish, but it wearies him to drag it back out to his mouth. 16, the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. Now, this last verse makes the sluggard have much in common with the one who is wise in his own eyes from verse 12, right? Therefore, the fool has greater reason for hope than the sluggard as well, right? Verse 17, whoever meddles in a quarrel not his own, is like one who takes a passing dog by the ears. Well, that conjures all kinds of images, doesn't it? Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, is the man who deceives his neighbor and then turns and says, I'm only joking. Verse 20 and 21. For lack of wood, the fire goes out. And where there is no whisperer, quarrels cease. As charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a quarrelsome man for kindling strife. That's just a good analogy. Verse 22 and 23. The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down to the inner parts of the body. Like the glaze covering an earthen vessel are fervent lips with an evil heart. Now, this one I thought was a little interesting. Again, the Masoretic text, which is what the King James and the New King James and so on use, clearly has silver dross, where we have glaze covering. In this case, I believe that the King James and the New King James is correct. While these are very different words in the Hebrew, and in other instances could throw off the flow and overall meaning of the text, in my view, either translation winds up conveying the intended point very nicely. Nevertheless, I believe the alteration from silver dross to glaze covering is both forced and unnecessary. The argument for changing it is that earthen vessels of the ancient Middle East did not typically have silver dross applied to them. Such would have been a silly investment since they were notoriously fragile and prone to cracking and breaking due to their inherent fragility and porous nature, and sometimes due to the harsh firing conditions, you know, when they would fire it to make it hard. They would often break soon after being crafted and need immediate repairs or simply be discarded. So it would be kind of silly to put silver on top of it, you know. As such, silver was, which was a precious and rare commodity in other kingdoms, would not be wasted on inferior or fragile vessels. Furthermore, there were what were called sumptuary laws in these nations surrounding Israel at the time of this writing, 3,500 years ago in the Middle East. Now, a sumptuary law are laws that dictated what people could wear, eat, own, based on their social rank, their wealth, or moral or religious beliefs. Okay? Israel had some of those. Like, in other words, one of them was there were certain things that the priests could wear. Nobody else in Israel were allowed to. If you did, you were sinning, because this configuration, God hallowed and made it sacred for priestly use at all, alone. Same thing for some of the incense. If you were to use those incense for any of that configuration of the way the incense were crafted for priestly use in the tabernacle and tried to use it for common use, you would get the wrath of God on you, because what you're doing is you're taking something that was symbolic of something holy and using it for something common, right? And that was breaking a law. So it was set apart for religious use, not for common use. That would be a sumptuary law, okay? There were also sumptuary laws, like I said, that had to do with your rank and your status. If you were a poor person, you were not allowed to wear certain clothes, like in Egypt. I'm just making one up. I don't know off the top of my head. I know there were these laws in Egypt. But like, it would have been, even if you were gifted it or somehow gotten to the possession of a garment that had gold interwoven in it, if you were a commoner and they saw you with that, you'd be in big trouble, because that kind of stuff can only be worn by the wealthy and the elite. And if you wear it as a commoner, that's a no-no, you just broke a law. Do you see what I'm saying? Well, the same was true about a lot of vessels. And so it would have been, these laws were intended to curb extravagance and reinforce social hierarchies. So you can see that there are plenty of reasons to question this wordage, right, of a silver dross on a clay pot. However, in Israel, during the time of Solomon's reign, silver was common. Everybody had silver. I mean, there was the poorest man had more silver than he could use, okay? Because Solomon's reign brought great prosperity to Israel. That was not true of surrounding nations. Surrounding nations, silver was still rare and precious. But in Israel, everybody had silver, plenty of it, right? So therefore, it didn't have the social status attached to it, even though in Jerusalem, Jewish society, there wasn't a, they weren't allowed to be boastful, so there wasn't a social status or hierarchy to maintain. But nonetheless, it would have been common and may have been used with earthen pottery, but archaeological evidence does not support that this was ever a common thing in Israel to pour silver over pottery. So what do we do with this? There is, however, archaeological evidence and textual analysis in that indicates that the substance referred to as silver dross in the Bible, the Hebrew word being sigim, was actually a form of lead oxide, litharge, slag, produced during silver refining, therefore be called silver dross. And this material was indeed used as a glaze for pottery in the ancient Near East, including in the general region of ancient Israel. What is produced was a brilliant glassy finish and colors leaning towards the yellow and the green. What is it more important to the meaning of this proverb is the intent of doing this to an earthen vessel. It was partly to enhance the visual appeal, and in some context, to even make the vessel appear to be of greater value than it really was. Okay? Like if you were to polish brass, it can make it look like it's gold, even though it's not, right? Okay? And that is how it serves as a good illustration for fervent lips with an evil heart. The words fervent lips means burning or glowing. The Septuagint translates these words flattering lips. What do flattering lips do? Well, they dress up words to convey messages which are not necessarily true, or at least situationally embellished in order to gain advantage. You flatter to gain advantage. Such words are employed by those with an evil heart. So the entire idea seems to be that those who dress up their words in order to flatter and gain advantage have an evil heart, in the same way that silver dross glaze dresses up an ordinary clay vessel to look like something that it's not. Okay? So I had fun researching this one because on the surface, I'm like, well, that at first it didn't make any sense to me. My first question that I looked up in the search was, why would anybody put silver on a clay pot? You know, weren't they pretty fragile? And so I made sure I targeted my question to in the Middle East around Israel 3,500 years ago, were clay pots generally fragile? And the answer was absolutely yes. Most of the time, many times, they would break before they could even be sold because they were just so fragile. And so, well, then why would anybody put silver on that? That makes no sense. So I'm thinking through this and had to study it, but this is what I found out. It probably was, like it says, the dross, which was a lead-based substance that was left over from the refining process of silver. And that was put, well, a very, very, very brilliant method. It took two different types of refining in the fire to make this adhere. And it also would make the vessel, if you put it on the inside, water resistant. So it had a practical application as well, but most of the time it was made to dress it up, look nicer than it was, and more valuable than it was. So now a person of this same moral caliber, meaning a person who flatters with their lips, is further described in the next three verses, 24 through 26. Whoever hates disguises himself with his lips and harbors deceit in his heart. When he speaks graciously, believe him not. For there are seven abominations hidden in his heart. Though his hatred be covered with deception, his wickedness will be exposed in the great assembly. So this is talking about a person who hides things with his words, right? Like a flatterer. Verse 27, whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on the one who starts it rolling. And verse 28, a lying tongue hates its victim, and a flattering mouth works ruin. Those last two didn't need any type of help. They speak for themselves. So, does anybody have any questions or thoughts about what we covered in chapter 26?
So after
fun. I had fun researching this one because there was at least three real puzzles in there that I enjoyed researching. So, yeah, go ahead.
I had a question.
Sure.
Something you mentioned in passing, and not really to do with these scriptures, but you said something about no, and I may have got it all wrong, no social status among in Israel. You're talking about...
Oh, yeah. I mean, meaning to uphold. In other words, they didn't have what was considered a class system, okay? Where I live in the East End and you poor people live in the West End, or vice versa, depending on where you are. There wasn't a class system like that. And I'm not saying that they never had that, but it was against, if they ever did it, it was against the law. I mean, the moral law that God had written. You don't show a difference in the way that you treat a person based on how much money they have. There's not a specific law that says it that way, but the idea is definitely consistent with the Old Testament law. You don't treat people that way. I mean, even if you, if a brother was in debt to you, a brother Jew, a fellow Jew was in debt to you, and they had to sell themselves into servitude to you for a number of years, there were laws of how you had to treat them with respect. They could be treated like garbage, you know, and the same was true with foreigners. If you were to conquer another land and take some of their people as your slaves, you couldn't treat them like they were animals. The law didn't allow that. Now, I'm not saying Israel didn't break those laws, but the law existed. So that's what I mean by that. There wasn't a hierarchical structure in Israel where the poor people have to stay over there and the rich people stay over here by law. Did it sometimes happen? Yeah, but that was when they were walking in disobedience. Yes, uh-huh.
Doesn't it seem like it kind of did that on a regular, though?
Yeah, they broke the law regularly. Yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch of scriptures where, you know, don't choose the best seat lest you be shamed, because clearly there was a best seat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was a structure.
In the example he was giving, he was talking about in a church setting. Mm-hmm. And in the church setting, a place where you can actually see what's going on in the front would be considered a better seat. It's not like the seat was gilded with gold and therefore was considered preferred because the seat itself is better. Just relative to, it's like if I go to a stadium to go see a football game, if you're in the nosebleed section and you have to have binoculars, it's considered a lesser seat than right up at the ring. But the reason it is because the distance in which you can see. But it wasn't also a social status.
They would also boast about, you know, well, I'm of a Paul. Well,
exactly, yes. Yeah.
Clearly they're a social status symbol because,
yeah,
well, I'm better than you because I'm from Paul.
Yeah. So they created those. But in Israel, as far as the law was concerned, there was no, you couldn't support that by the law of Moses. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You wouldn't be sent to prison for saying I'm from Paul.
No. You wouldn't have been sent to prison. But it was definitely considered something that was immoral and unjust. Any other thoughts?
Just another perspective there. You know, look at the things that happened in the New Testament. And because the Jewish system, because it was a lot of tradition that was upheld, I'm sure there was a lot of stuff that stayed the same. But, I mean, you look at how we are within 100 years and how different our culture is from the way it was 100 years
ago. Oh, my gosh, yes.
And, you know, so who knows just what kind of changes were made from Solomon's time to the time of Jesus.
In the way that they thought. Yes. Well, and they were also coming out of 400 years of God not speaking to Israel. There was no prophetic word for 400 years. So they were probably a lot more, they were definitely Hellenized by the influence of Rome, without question. But also, you have to consider that things that God had set up on purpose to keep Israel pure and separated from the world was later interpreted by Israelites in a snobbish way, because they intended them not to associate with Gentiles, not to eat with them. And the reason and way God did accomplish that goal of encouraging them to come out from among the world and be separate from them was creating dietary laws and rules for living that made them distinct from their neighbors. They couldn't eat with them and keep the law at the same time. Well, over a period of time, they turned this into a snobbery way of thinking that, well, we're better than they are. Well, that's not what God was saying. God was saying, I want you to live in a way that is separated unto me, And it wasn't because the things that God told them to eat or not eat were by themselves bad. How do I know that? Because Paul said in the New Covenant, he said, nothing's to be refused if it's received with thanksgiving. God created all of it, right? God created those laws back there with the pure intent of separating them from the nations around them. So, but over the period of time, Israelites began to think of themselves higher than they should think and thought, well, we're better than them. So when the new birth came around and now Gentiles and Jews are of one body, a lot of Jews were grossed out by that because they had come to look at Gentiles as though they were pigs, filthy animals, dogs, unworthy of my attention, unworthy of me coming near them. And I would never enter into one of their houses. Oh my gosh, how gross. I'd have to take 15 baths just to walk by their front door. They're so disgusting animals. That's the way they began to think. So that you can see that would be a stumbling block once you get born again. And you got Gentiles that are born again. And now you're like, I've lived my whole life looking at them as disgusting beasts. And now I'm to call them brother. It was a real hurdle. So, but it wasn't a hurdle because God intended it to be thought the way it was. It was intended to separate them, not to denigrate the people they're being separated from. You see what I'm saying? And because they turned it into that, they made their own hurdle to have to overcome once they came to Christ. It wasn't one that was native to the law, it's what they did to it. So, and that's the way we are, human beings. You know, we always like to make ourselves feel better by putting the other guy down. So, all right, well, that's it. That's all there is to chapter 26. I know there's some deeper ones in there that took a bit to go through, but again, it's really unavoidable if you're going to understand what the text is really talking about. And in case, again, like I said, if you do read multiple translations and you see a really big difference, I think it's important to address that. So, all right, I'm going to go ahead and close in prayer.